How long are you going to live? Well, today we are going to talk about life expectancy. Can you live to 120? And do you want to? We're going to learn more today on our debut episode of season 2 about life expectancy. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More. It's Russ with you. It is our debut of season 2. Yeah, I love that we're entering season 2. We've made a slight change to the way that we pull together the topics for each one of the episodes. We're going to be doing a series of 3 podcasts on a particular topic. So every 3 episodes, we'll switch up a topic. So the first topic is about aging. And we are going to cover this from 3 different directions. First, today, we're going to talk about life expectancy. Then next week, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's and dementia, followed by finances. Yeah, that's a big topic, right? Like retirement planning. Like, can you actually retire? What can you do today to make it so that you can retire tomorrow? We're going to learn more about that in the coming weeks. But today, we are going to talk about life expectancy. I am joined by Regents and Distinguished Professor from Texas A&M School of Public Health, Marcia Ori. Marcia, thank you so much for joining me.
I'm delighted to be here talking with you today.
Well, I was so glad that I found you online. Like, this was a great discovery. You did an article about life expectancies and this expectation on healthy aging. So I really wanted to learn more about this topic. So thank you for joining me. Okay, so looking at the stats, you know, because I always love to, I'm kind of a data nerd. And I looked at stats as far as aging goes. And some stats, it depends on which surveys you're looking at, but some say that by 2080 or so, the life expectancy could be up to 100. Some say that by 2300, it'll be that, right? So it depends. But at some point, we're going to get there where the life expectancy is 100. I did this little survey for myself. I found this website and it's kind of neat. I'll put a link in the description called longevityillustrator.org. And I was able to put my age in there and answer some simple questions. And it gave me kind of my chances of living to certain ages. So I've got about a little less than 10% chance of living to 100, according to this. But hey, I'll take that. That's pretty good. Thinking about life expectancy and this rise in the numbers. First of all, how do we get there? How do we get to be a centurion?
Well, everybody ages from the moment they're conceived. And I think it's important to separate out 2 concepts. One is life expectancy, and that's the average age that you're expected to live for people born today, people 65 and older, and even 85 and older. So the actuarials can tell us average life expectancy. That's different from lifespan. Lifespan is how long an individual human can live. And the oldest living person is a Japanese woman who's about 118. So that's lifespan. Life expectancy is different because it is not how long will an individual live, but on average for the country you live in, how long will the average person live after certain criteria, birth or 65. So you're right. If you think about, you're a guy who loves stats. In the 1900s, the average life expectancy was 47. Hmm. Fast forward 120 years, and it's around 80. But that life expectancy is not the same for everyone. It's different for men versus women. And guess who lives longer in most countries?
The women, right?
And the U.S. doesn't even have the highest life expectancy of major industrialized countries. It's like way down there. It's
really
much lower than you expect. The most interesting fact on life expectancy is that it has dropped in the last year. Always life expectancy since the 1900s keeps going up and up. Mm-hmm. But if you look at the last census report, it started plateauing off a couple of years ago, and people said maybe it's the opioid crises. Now with the COVID pandemic for the last year, the life expectancy has dropped more than any other time in history, other than World War II, when there were a lot of war fatalities. So life expectancy generally has gone up. Right now, it's plateauing and even going down. And if you're in a less privileged group, a lower income group, or a minority group, it has gone down dramatically in more than a year or so. So in general, it's gone up, but it depends who you are, where it's going to be, and lately it's plateaued or gone down.
Yeah, I think some of the data that I saw from the CDC, and I believe this was back in 2018, some of that decline in it was actually happening even back then, and that was because of drug use and suicide. Are those kind of the leading factors in what's going on in the United States?
I think people will say the opioid crisis. The newest news about that is in the last year, there have been 100,000 opioid-related deaths. Finally, over 100,000. If you think about the pandemic and the deaths, not just for older people, but now people of all ages, that's one of the things. But, you know, average life expectancy is just one thing. The reality is the population is still aging. So you talked about what's going to happen in 2080. Most people talk about what happens when the baby boomers become of age. So every single baby boomer is 65. You know, by 20, 30 plus, they'll all be over 65. So that's why people are projecting that one in five Americans will be 65 and older. And you started talking about, well, what about centenarians and what about super centenarians? Yes, the fastest growing segment of the American population are those people over 65. It's people over 85 and also over 100. But fastest growing, you have to take the fact that there were fewer centenarians. So any growth in that area is going to make it look like the numbers are increasing. The absolute numbers are small, but the proportions are growing.
Yeah, it's like a few thousand people that have made it over like 110, right?
And 110 is not even a super centenarian. That's 120.
Oh, wow.
And what people do think, I mean, in classes, what people say is, what I'll say in one of my public health classes, look around. A lot of you who are 20 to 25 now are going to live to 100. Mm. And that's shocking because I think kids don't think that they're going to live forever, at least that old. And then the question is, do you want to live that old? And what do you think they say?
They say no, or they say yes. I have no idea.
It's only if I can be healthy. People would love to live to 100 or 120 if they could be as healthy as they were at 50. But the reality is most diseases and most disabilities are age-related. It doesn't mean that aging is going to, that disease is going to be inevitable. So everybody now talks about dementia. Yes, there will be more Americans with dementia and more burdens on care as the population ages. But it doesn't mean that everybody 65 or 75 or 85 will get dementia. So it's that statistics are usually aggregate. It won't tell you how long an average person lived. So the life expectancy when George Washington was born was really low, but he tripled or more. Just because the average person lives a certain amount of years doesn't mean that somebody's not going to live a lot longer and somebody else is going to live a lot less.
Your students that are saying, well, if I'm healthy, like, what can we do? Is there anything that, what's the suggestion, I guess? I mean, other than just eating well and all of that?
Yeah. The suggestion is don't think of health as a magic bullet. Don't think that you're going to get a pill that's going to make you live to 100 healthily. So why, you know, what healthy aging and what longevity is all about are three or four different things. And I wrote about that in the article. One, it's who you are. It's your genetic makeup. If you come from long-lived parents, you're probably more likely to live a longer period of time. But you have to consider why your parents died. So if they died in the 1900s because of an infectious disease that now has a cure, that's not going to be as related. Then it's what you do, and it's exactly what you got to just got through saying, Russ. That's all the lifestyle behaviors, and everybody knows it. Everybody knows that you should be physically active. You should eat healthily, which means lay off of fat foods, eat more fruit and vegetables. Everybody knows that if you're going to drink, you should drink to moderation. But people know those things. What they know less about are those more social determinants of health. And that is the importance of the environment. It's where you live and who you interact with. So being socially connected is another factor. People who are lonely and socially isolated live less long, they're more unhappy, and they're more physically unwell. So there are easy ways to get to an aged stage in better health. But the other point that's so important is you just don't wake up one day at 65 and you're old or 85. From the moment you're born, everything you do will influence the age, how you age over time. And so that's why in the gerontological field, we talk about aging as a life course phenomena. It's what you do in high school. It's what you do as a young adult. It's what you do when you're middle-aged, and then what you do when you're older. But there are a couple of good pieces of news. And one is, it's never too early to start being, you know, thinking about what can make you be to age better. But it's also never too late. You can be 65 and pretty sedentary and have some chronic conditions, but you can turn around your life trajectory by becoming more physically active, by keeping your chronic conditions in control, by being socially connected, by volunteering. So it's, you know, never too early to start, and it's never too late to start too. Taking care of yourself and thinking about making healthy aging the new normal.
Okay, that's great that you said that it's never too late, because I when you were talking about, you know, early on, I was thinking about all those like Taco Bell visits that I made when I was a kid. That's probably not the best choice for back then. I've stopped that now. Okay, so let's talk not just about quality of life, but let's also talk about life satisfaction and happiness, because quality of life could mean your finances or your health. Life satisfaction is just about happiness.
It's interesting, because when they have national surveys and they ask who's happy, you would think that older people would say they're less happy. When they did all the surveys during the COVID pandemic and they asked how people were coping, who do you think coped the poorest?
Was it the older?
It was not the older people.
No, really.
It's 18 to 24-year-olds that had the hardest time. Older people reevaluate what aging means, and they think about meaning and purpose in life. And so there are psychologists who've done studies, and they really show that older people have emotional resilience. They've been through a lot of problems in life, and they've learned how to cope and adapt. And plus, the other thing is, the older you get, you start thinking about time left to live. You reevaluate and reframe. So it's, why am I sitting here complaining about the things I can't do? I need to be thinking about the things I can still do. I'm comparing myself not to what I was at 20 or 50, but I might be comparing myself to my neighbor who's in a wheelchair. I'm just in a walker. So again, the referent group changes of what your comparison is, and you try to find meaning in those years left. That's, you know, so quality of life doesn't mean, and sometimes people talk about healthy aging. Healthy aging doesn't mean you don't have a disease, you don't have a disability, but rather it's about the functional ability you have to do the things that are important to you and that have value. So if you can still pick up the phone, still pick up the iPad, you know, talk to your children, talk to your grandchildren, that can give you pleasure in life.
You had mentioned earlier, and that goes directly with what you were saying about the whole isolation thing, right? Those in isolation don't do as well. Well, if you have, you know, FaceTime and phone to talk to people that are in your family, I do feel like technology does help with that a lot.
Technology helps a lot, but let me just say one thing first. Loneliness is not about being alone. A person who lives alone, an older woman who lives alone by herself, can be socially connected, whether by technology or going out for groups. You can live in an apartment house and still with people all around you and still feel lonely because you might not have those skills or desire to connect to other people. So loneliness doesn't mean being alone, and being in a group doesn't mean you'll be socially connected. But what we learned during the pandemic is that people did use technology, particularly older adults who were in assisted living or nursing homes where you were federally mandated to be on lockdown, but you were on lockdown. Yeah. There were no visitors allowed. So the other thing is people have that stereotype that an older person can't understand or use technology. It is amazing how fast this older generation that maybe didn't use iPads before learned how to get on Facebook. Mm-hmm. They learned how to get on chat groups. And in fact, you know, there were even people teaching you how to do that, recognizing how important it was to stay socially connected. So you're right, technology can help. But just this next, you know, we're talking, you know, 2 years plus in the pandemic, and people now are really eager to get back to family. So they want to be close. There is something about being in person, touching, hugging. It's those kind of things that traditionally made people feel connected. That's what I think people have missed. In public health, the rules are, you know, about the question, what's going to happen getting together for the holidays, and the importance of being vaccinated, the importance of making sure everyone's vaccinated and even boosted so that you can get together, so you can hug, you can like be close together.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought up the pandemic, and I want to touch on that a little bit more. Plus, we've got so many other topics to talk about, but we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the pandemic and its impact on life expectancy. We'll be right back with more Learning More. If you enjoy history, maybe you're just feeling a little nostalgic, or you wonder who's having a birthday today, or maybe you need a reason to celebrate. Well, we've got the perfect podcast for you. It is called This Is Today. And each and every day, we talk about the historic events, celebrity birthdays. We also talk about whatever is going on today. There's always something to celebrate when you listen to This Is Today. And at just 10 minutes each day, you can make it a daily habit. You can even add it to your Alexa Flash briefing. Click the link in the description or just search in your favorite podcast app for This Is Today. Thanks for listening and subscribing to Learning More. This is our second season here. We are in the first episode of a three-part series on aging. I'm talking with Marcia about life expectancy. And just before the break, we started to touch on the pandemic. Well, during the Spanish flu, we saw a huge drop in life expectancy numbers right after that and the years following that. And hopefully we're in the years following this pandemic. But Marcia, are we going to see a huge drop in life expectancy over the coming years?
We've already seen that for the last year that there was a drop in life expectancy. You're right. So it's the Spanish flu, it's World War II. Mm-hmm. It's those events where lots of people are dying who wouldn't normally die. That's why we're seeing the drop in life expectancy. It killed a lot of people in the U.S. And I can't even, you know, at one point I could tell you, too, the number, how many people have died with COVID. It keeps going up. And it certainly has gone up and down and up and down. And now people think up again. That is definitely going to impact life expectancy.
I said I had, well, I've got a less than 10% chance, but I got a 20% chance of living to 95. So we'll go with that one. But does that mean, oh, shoot, can I retire at 65?
Okay, well, that's why I think we have to rethink how society deals with the aging population. Because historically, people worked and they died relatively close to, you know, the end of work. Now you could have 20 or 30 years in retirement. So a couple of things need to be done. One, for those people who want to work and are capable of fulfilling their jobs, then employers should figure out how to keep these people on and be supportive. Sometimes people retire because they're plenty healthy, but they have an older parent to take care of, and that pulls them out of the workforce. And now we know that we have a workforce labor shortage, particularly of people who were trained in certain professions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's really important in the workplace to make it as supportive as possible for people who are capable to stay in the workplace. But for those people who choose not to be in the workplace, to have alternatives for them. So one alternative is lifelong education. Mm-hmm. It's going back to college. There are people that you read about that say, I always wanted to get a college degree, but I had to work, you know, drop out and work, take care of my family. And now I'm 90 and I'm getting a college degree. Nice. So I think that universities have to rethink who their students might be. What else can older people do? Because I talked about how important it was to have meaningful roles. Volunteering is really important. You think you're helping other people, but in reality, volunteering helps your health overall, your mental health, your well-being, your physical health, so you can volunteer.
That's also, that's being with groups where they share the same interests. That's great.
And then there have to be places where people can live. If you ask what people want to do when they get older, the majority of people will say, I want to stay in my own home. I don't want to go to a nursing home. I don't want to go to assisted living, even though those two styles are improving dramatically. Mm-hmm. So in order to stay in your own home, technology has enabled us to do this. Think of sort of smart homes that turn on and off the lights. They make it safer. There are also the falls alerts so that if you are home alone, you can have an alert that will go to either your healthcare provider or to a loved one who doesn't live with you. So there are many ways of being, you know, being retired, what you can do for the next 30 or 40 years and how you can do it safely.
On that, I mean, I do feel like there's a bit of this stigma around assisted living because I think people kind of pull assisted living and like nursing home into those same sort of things. What the assisted livings that I've been to have been like cruise ships. I mean, they're so much fun. You know, like I would love to do it. You know,
my mom was in assisted living for about 10 years and she was never so active. I would go and visit her. I'd be exhausted at the end of the day. So I think that there are different kinds of assisted living. Some units sort of grew out of the hospitality industry, what you said, like being on a cruise ship. Mm-hmm. So they want a social model, but also to provide some basic personal care needs,
right,
kind of things like medication, so that you know you're getting your medication, so that you're getting the meals, so you don't have to go out and shop and cook.
Yeah.
What is happening, though, I think policy-wise, many states are doing waivers to enable people to stay at home and have home care brought in. That used to be something you had to do out of pocket. But some states are saying, let's take a person who might otherwise be in a nursing home at 90,000 plus, and now it may even be an average of about 100,000. If you live in California, it's probably pretty expensive. So let's take that money and instead give an older person some personal care a couple of times a week. Will that make a difference? Will that enable them to stay in their own environment even for a year or more? You've saved the 90 or the 100K, and you've probably improved that person's quality of life at the same time.
Cost is such a big issue with all of this. You know, the from assisted living to like in-home care, like those items. I mean, it's like insane how much. Now, I'm in California, like you said, and you know, here. So for in-home care, for 24-hour in-home care, right? If you actually had somebody come in, it's about $16,000 to $17,000 a month in the San Francisco Bay Area.
And who can afford that? The question is, Russ, who can afford it? So that's why, let me go back to a topic we talked about before, which was healthy aging. I don't know if you or your listeners know, but this is the World Health Organization's decade of healthy aging. So not just a day of healthy aging, not just a year, but it's a whole decade. And they have four sectors of action. So the first is combating ageism. We sort of, you know, talked about that. We can talk about that a little bit more. But the second is building age-friendly communities. So it's making sure that older people can live in the community safely and function to their ability. The third area is integrated healthcare. So we know in America, unfortunately, that healthcare is not very integrated, that you go to primary care for one thing, you might go to specialty care, you might go to the ER, you might be in the hospital, you might be in and out, and sometimes it's not coordinated with all those different places you go. So we really need to integrate the care, and people are talking about almost care passports. So I'm Russ, and today I've been to see my primary care doctor, and tomorrow I go to my specialist. I might have a bad adverse reaction to my medication, so I'm in the ER. Everybody needs to know what happens to you.
Right.
But the third area, and we can talk about any of these, the fourth area is long-term care. And what this does is it changes the meaning of aging and dignity in life. So we no longer want long-term care to be thought of as warehousing. Right. Whatever it is, palliative care, long-term care, to respect the dignity of older people and let their last year, days, moments of life be lived with dignity. So that's all of the different ways that we can create healthy aging globally and in California and in Texas.
So we have an entire episode just on retirement planning, finances. We're going to do that in just two episodes from now. So if you're listening to this live, it's 2 weeks from now that will be released. I'll be talking with David Blanchett. He's got 20 plus years experience in researching retirement planning and finances. So definitely do check that episode out. And you know, one of the things that we discuss in that episode is about the sandwich generation or multiple sandwich generations.
The boomers' parents had multiple kids. So, you know, the generation ahead, my mother's generation, the sort of depression generation, they had 3 to 5 kids to take care of them. Now boomers have had fewer children. We have more diverse family arrangements. We have people married not just once, 2 times, 3 times, who knows what the average is in California. But it means that there may be or not as strong ties, whereas always before the assumption was that children would take care of parents. Now we have a couple of things. People are living longer, so you're now expecting somebody 75 to take care of somebody 100,
right.
Somebody 50 to take care mm-hmm. of somebody 75 and 100, and then the sort of multiple sandwich generations. It used to just be three, but now with longevity, there could be four generations, fewer people to take care of, and more people needing care.
Right. Yeah. You're looking at triple decker sandwiches in a way, where you've got multiple people on either side that you're taking care of. So, okay. You mentioned ageism, and I want to dig into that a little bit more. That of course is a concern in the workplace, right? Where, God, and really in society in general, it seems, okay. So one of the things, and now I'm just kind of saying what I've done and what is great about technology. I mean, so I went to school for marketing and business, right? Like, okay, specifically marketing. And if you're talking about marketing, well, they didn't have digital marketing when I went to college. And whoever's in college right now, the technology is going to change over the next decade anyway. So whatever you're learning about Facebook or Instagram or whatever, it's going to change in 5 years. It's going to change in 10 years. It's going to be completely different. So yes, you can apply kind of those principles of marketing, but you've always got to be learning. And that is what I like about a lot of these tools out there. I mean, I do so much learning online, whether it be just, you know, YouTube or actual formal classes through, you know, Coursera or some of these other places that are online.
Aren't you glad that people don't look at you, Russ, and say, you're not 20, you're a technophobe? I mean, in
right.
reality, that stereotype, the stereotype is, the positive stereotype is, if you want help on a device, you go to a kid 18 years or younger.
Right.
You know, that's the joke. On the negative side, it is the expectation that older people are not familiar or able to deal with technology or things that are new. So the reason why ageism is so important is it's actually a health hazard. And what I mean by that is they've done a lot of studies where they ask people about their attitudes about aging. And those people who personally hold negative attitudes, they're less healthy, they have more chronic conditions, and they die prematurely. So they sort of believe, you know, if they believe that they're not capable or don't have a certain skill set, then they're not going to act in a more proactive way. And it's really a health hazard.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
But ageism is so sort of embedded in our society. I'm a fellow in the Gerontological Society of America, and they've come together with a lot of the aging sector organizations to have this whole new movement, and it's called Reframing Aging. And it starts with the language we use. And so we don't refer to an older person as a geezer, an old bag, or all those kind of things. We don't say, oh, that person's senile, because that language is so stereotypic. What they're trying to do is to facilitate the language which is used that will give respect to older people. So you never say now that demented person, you say that person living with dementia. Again, it's the respect for older people at every stage of life, at every sort of health condition.
The light bulb that went on as you were talking there, somebody may not believe that they should leave their specific role that they're in, and they may put up with the lower pay and the stress of the job just because they don't feel like, because of their age, maybe they don't want to put themselves out there to other places because they fear that somebody's not going to hire them because of their age.
There are some truisms, and that is, if you are out of work at 50 and looking for work, it's going traditionally to take you longer than a younger person. Now, maybe with a worker shortage, it might not take as long, but there is some truth to that. But what you have to do, in the same way that people who are coming out of college now, this has not been a good job market for them.
Right.
And in that sense, you have to put yourself out there. You have to know that it's not going to be you knock on the first door and they're going to say, you're just the person we're looking for. We're going to give you a great salary. But it's being able to sell yourself with the skills that you have and what you can do for the company. And so you can do that at 20, you can do that at 50, and you can even do that at 70. It's having a sense of worth and what you are able to do. And that's mm-hmm. because you're not assuming I'm old and nobody wants to hire me.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, it's getting past that in your own head too. Not just, you know, like just assuming that other people might think that. Do we need more protections in place for this?
Well, certainly there are job protections, but this tells you how old the protections are. The age discrimination law, anybody over 40, that must have gone in when a long time ago. You right. know, so the protections that I think that you need are workplaces understanding the value of older people. It's having what we call age-friendly societies, age-friendly cities, or dementia-friendly cities, where the protections are for an older person who might be scammed. Now, when you're sitting at home, I don't know how often you get, you know, somebody wants to sell you something, somebody wants yeah. to, you yeah. know, give you something at a price that's mm-hmm. unbelievable. You're lonely. Older people are often the targets of these marketing scams. Yeah. The good news is AARP has really told people you don't, you know, that these are scams. Certainly people are still falling for them, but to a less degree than they might have in the past.
Yeah. Yeah. Those scams just drive me absolutely mad. I don't know how many I get in a day, but it's to the point of where I don't even want to answer my phone.
I know that somebody, the latest for me, 10 times a day, I have somebody who wants to pay cash for your house.
They can sound so real and scare you. I will do a future episode at some point on those scams because they just drive me absolutely mad. And I would love to get them back somehow. okay, so what are the disadvantages of living longer?
First of all, everyone doesn't age well. And so you might be in poorer health, whether it's mental or physical. You could have what we talked about, financial strains, particularly when older people are not, you know, older people are better off financially than ever before. But they say you're one fall or chronic condition away from a lot of, or, you know, from needing to spend a lot of money on personal care. Mm-hmm. So there's no sort of federal safety net for the day-to-day personal care that someone needs if they get to be 85 or 100 and are likely to need. So the downside to living a long time is not having the resources to live the way you did at 20 or 50 or 70. So that's a potential downside. Many people can achieve healthy aging, but like at any age, there are people who are more frail, there are people who have mental health problems. So, you know, there are downsides for the individual. I think there are downsides for society when you recognize, just like we needed the trillion billion dollar infrastructure bill, that the healthcare system is not working the way it should. The housing sector is not working the way it should. We know that people are attempting to do the right thing, but there's still not enough appropriate health care, not enough long-term care. not enough financial support and security for everyone, not enough housing. So that's the downside. Mm-hmm. The downside is that it sort of amplifies basic problems in society. That's what COVID did. That's what the opioid crisis has done. It's those ways in which our society could function better is getting strained. The other downside of living longer, it's going to put a huge burden on the remaining family caregivers. They're going to be stressed out. So they have to take care of themselves, their own families, as well as upper generations. Mm-hmm. So those are some of the downsides. But I think in every challenge, there are opportunities. And the opportunities are how we look at society and the supports that we can give older people, and how we ourselves as individual family members treat our older relatives, and how we view aging within ourselves. Those are all the sort of challenges, but opportunities.
Right, right. And that's why I kind of like to always ask one of those disadvantage or, you know, challenges questions, because that I feel like is something to make us think so that we can figure out those opportunities and hopefully make some sort of positive change. Mm-hmm. I think another positive change is just, you know, for those listening to this podcast, you learned a lot about this. And Marcia, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been a delight chatting with you.
And there you have it, our first episode of season two completed. We've got two more episodes on aging, so make sure that you check those out. Next week, we're going to talk about Alzheimer's and dementia. I've got a person that hosts a podcast that actually interviews people that are suffering with dementia and the caregivers. She started an entire organization around dementia and Alzheimer's, and we'll learn more about that next week. And then the week after, as I mentioned earlier, we do have a retirement and your finances podcast. What can you do today to help retire tomorrow? Yeah, we'll be talking about that. Hey, I want to thank you for listening and subscribing to Learning More. We encourage you to, and thank you for rating this podcast and sharing it with your friends. As with any podcast that gives really any opinion-based information, it is not meant to substitute professional advice, and we encourage you to consult a professional to discuss your exact needs. I thank you for listening, for subscribing, and for rating Learning More. I'm Russ, and I look forward to learning more with you next time.